I'd like to say thanks to Paul for the invitation to read here tonight and for all of you for coming along. Sometimes in selecting reading material, poems grouped together for their own sake and decided they were going to be read as a group, and I have a couple of those this evening. I'm going to start with a poem, there's two of them together about the same subject matter, and I was very lucky to be invited on a women's poetry tour some years ago, and the tour went to England, France and Belgium. And part of that tour was that each poet had to read in their own language, so I got to read in Irish for the first time in my life, and the last time in my life. It's really bad, I'm embarrassed to say, but it was a wonderful experience getting to read in Irish. And all the other poets read in their own language, and I suppose it was my first experience of hearing poetry read in a language that I didn't actually understand. And we were lucky enough that a translator read in English afterwards for everybody, but there was something wonderful about listening to somebody reading their poetry in their own language. It was very inspiring. And so there was poets from England, France and Belgium, and one of the English poets was actually from the Caribbean. And I wrote this poem when I came home after the experience. It's called Inspiration. Today I'm sick with poetry. I vomit poems in ink red as blood onto white ruled pages, spattering my sore innards on floors and walls. Words that belong to the spirit who pats my back as another wave of retching comes. That's it. Get it up. You'll feel better. He's wrong. I don't. The words keep coming, wave after wave of sickness. My knees wobble, my skin hot. I reel, weak now on all fours. Still the words pour from me, but now they are not mine. They are peppered and diced, French rap Caribbean prose. A rhythm pulses through me. My limbs jump in spasm, and I am emptied, wasted. You have poisoned me with longing. So part of that poetry tour was that we got to go to many different places and read, which was, for me, was a really exciting experience because people were coming up asking for my autograph afterwards, which was kind of scary because I've never ever had anything like that before. Mm-hmm. But they also took us to various cultural events. And one of those cultural events was the ballet. They were going to take us off to the ballet. I'd never been to the ballet before. I was a little nervous about going because there was a dress code and we all were a little bit nervous, and it was 3 hours long and we were thinking, oh my God, it's going to be so boring. I've been there for the whole night. And we had nothing to expect, we didn't know what to happen. And we were staying in a really, really nice little hotel called The Pilgrim. And we were all getting ready beforehand. We were saying, oh, 3 hours, how would we put down 3 hours? And this poem is called The Bally Rambert. A dress code at the Marlowe, we were told, no jeans. So we donned St. Bernard's tights and heels, a vision in black and white, and took our seats with poise, as though you'd swear we were patrons of the art. Until beautiful buttocks of men in tights bounced in twirls and pirouettes. Spread-legged and sweaty, a line of well-dressed women moved in lustful fantasies with each twitch and titter of muscle. Jaw slackened and damp palms later, we returned to the Pilgrim, excited, giddy, and rang our men, who smiled with delight at our missing them. Since I went to school, since I was at school, I have a great passion for Picasso for some reason. I've always loved his work. And I was in a stately home one time with my husband now, but he was my boyfriend at the time, and his mom and dad. And there was a Picasso plate there. It was my first time being face to face with a real Picasso, I suppose. And it had a profound effect on me. This is called Blue Ceramic. Picasso died today, April 8th. In 1973, I wasn't even aware of my own self, not to mind the majesty of painters. Later, I saw a plate he made in the flesh. My hand trembled as I reached across the years to caress his ceramic half moons, feel the rush of torment fire up through my fingertips, vibrating my teeth, that pain to create, like needles under the skin. Often I remember that day, Andrew and his father standing in the parkland posing with the house, and inside that strange-shaped blue ceramic, his epithelial scraped on clay, his power glazed over. I could feel it, even then, meters from the house, pulsing like the firing had never cooled, and it had burned through the casing, the floor, the earth, the heat radiating up through the soles of my shoes. Many different things inspire me, I suppose. My mother was always a great inspiration for my work, and being a mother has also been very inspiring. And this next poem, I suppose it's a poem about hanging on to the ordinary moments in the growing of a child, which is difficult because they're very hard to hold on to because children grow so quickly. And this poem was actually winner of the Allingham Poetry Award in 2017. It's called Exploring You. You trace your rib cage, your fingers trickling over. You trace your rib cage, your fingers trickling over your carcass bones, awakening music in your muscles. Your small woman shell waiting to blossom to 7, to establish at 8, to ripen at 13. And as I close you into the Tarrytown robe, I want to hold you there, protect what is the white flesh of your arms and legs. The meat of you, the pure unconscious innocence of you. Hold it in my breath, in my ears, in the pores of my skin. Because we will not come here again, you and I. We will not revisit this, but move on to routine and tomorrows. We will not know the point in the future. We will not look back and see this ordinary day. It will just melt into a general knowledge category we will never be examined on. I don't want to let it go. I don't want to forget your crazy song and sing along, or how you invited me to dip my feet in your bath, like 2 fishing lines dangling over the edge, or how, like Jesus, you washed my feet, taking such care, as if the very movement of the water, the tides of you and me, would wash away every other knowing, but not us, not our knowing, not our skin, our smile, our shared marrow. Only this day, the light breaking through the clouds, the drip of the tap, the chatter of the birds, the seconds of the clock. Woo. I'm from Mill Street, County Cork originally, so I'm a Cork woman. And where I grew up, we went swimming in the Black Water, which was about a mile and a half, I suppose, from our house. There were 7 in the family. So you went to the river with your brothers and sisters and you came home with your brothers and sisters. You never went on your own and you never stayed after they left. And this was the one and only time I stayed on my own. I got leathered. I don't think I could sit down for about 2 weeks afterwards when I was on my own. This is called Blackwater. The sun pierces the trees, putting pieces of sky in the black water. On the riverbank, a small pile of clothes topped by inflated orange armbands. And down by the dam, where the water squeezes through the gaps in the rocks, falling onto the shallow stone bed, filling the air with its sound, a young girl straining her neck out of the water, afloat with quick, frantic movements. The space is filled with the memory of noise. Tractor treks homeward after a busy day. The heat is fading, her jaw quivering. She can't go home, can't tell of her newfound ability. For tomorrow she could return with witnesses and not remember how. So this, there's 3 together. Again, like I said, they grouped themselves in this way. They decided this themselves, so they had nothing to do with it. And this is the first of the 3. And when my daughter was about 3 months old, I was very ill, and I ended up in intensive care. And when you end up in intensive care, your world shrinks down to that small area because you don't have visitors. You don't have anybody coming in and out of you except the medical staff and usually the nurses. And I was actually very lucky because I had no idea that I was as ill as I was. And one evening the nurse came in and she said, "I'm really sorry, we haven't been in to do your obs, Karen. We're very busy and I'll be in a minute." And I said, "It's okay." The nurse with the dark hair was in a while ago and she said, "Well, there's only two of us on tonight and neither of us have dark hair. This is called death in fishnet fights." Only afterwards I realised I'd met her. The brush of her hand along the nape of my neck, the smell of smoke in my nose hair, the tang of sulphur on my tongue. She was wearing fishnet tights with black curling hair to her shoulders, and she had the whitest skin. She never spoke. Being death, it was unnecessary. But as the living threaded in and out of my world, she remained just beyond the wooden frame, often coming as far as the foot of my bed, and then retreating, as if my life was being written line by line, and she was waiting her cue from the wings. Mm-hmm. On the same subject line, I suppose, having a serious illness is a little bit like being, I suppose, taken apart and put back together again. You're not quite the same afterwards. And for me, I suppose the difficult things were that I had problems remembering things, or worse, I remember things that weren't actually correct. And I'd often forget words. I could be having a conversation and I'd forget a word, or I'd get stuck in a word and I wouldn't be able to find it, it just wouldn't be there. So this poem is called The Shape of Her History. Like discarded rags, her memory regurgitates moments, crumpled and bent, often joining unrelated bits, substituting her for her sisters, strangers, news stories, fiction, until she reassembles like a collage of many jigsaws, often missing an eye, a cheekbone, a breast, ill-fitting pieces raised in relief. In this state of disassembly, she listens to her parts slip in and out of joining, trying to fit into the smooth picture of her placing. She's Picasso's woman in a red hat, in a Turner landscape, her lines all out of tune. And when she speaks, her language is unrecognizable, like birdsong or baby talk. And deep inside, she feels a pain she has no right to possess, burning between her womb and her esophagus, a remnant of truth. And this is the third one in the same sequence. And there was 14 steps on our stairs, and I might as well have been Mount Everest, those 14 steps, when I came home. And I suppose, even though this poem is really about how the outside world, my garden particularly, reflected my absence for me, and it's called 14 Steps and it's dedicated to Andrew. The garden has reclaimed my flower beds, the grass, centimetre by millimetre, crawling over the red and yellow bricks, sucking them down, disappeared as if they never existed, then marching on to smother the sweet pea stems, strangling the verbena, the sturdy oxalis choking out its last delicate bud, before succumbing to the approaching force, leaving only the memory of its colour brightening that western corner, a slight rise that hints at cultivation, a shade variance in the grass, as if sweeter, more delicate here, where potash and moss peat enriched the soil. For me, it signifies my retreat, my failed steps over the uneven ground, my unwillingness to seek help, to allow another's hand to shape my landscape. And yet you have struggled beneath my weight, brought me out centimetre by millimetre across the path, the rotting flower baskets, the uneven steps, to perch me here in the south-facing niche, surveying nature's triumphs or adaptability, leaving me to germinate, slowly drawing my head up, tilting to catch the sun, opening my display. My dad was a great fan of the races. And he went to many race meetings, but he never missed St. Stephen's Day. And after he died, myself and my brothers used to go every St. Stephen's Day in memory of him. And this is called Limerick Races. We make the pilgrimage in your honour, suffer the bitter cold, to feel the flutter you felt when 14 horses moved towards one goal, one line, and victory. With a pound each way, I know why you left us each St. Stephen's Day, made the journey, never missed us, while we sat at home and wondered where you went. In truth, we try, but history holds the last card, and we're all magpies too, like you, guaranteed to pick the loser. We laugh as you would have about our failures on the field, and when the cold seeps through our shoes, we'll down hot whiskey in your memory and wonder why their warmth will never reach our feet before the odds are given and we're our father's children. So the next three are all about, I suppose, the loss of my mother in different guises. And for anybody really who's lost a mother, I suppose they're so significant in our lives and they leave such a hole when they're gone. So this is just called Mother. You kept our curls in greaseproof paper, our baby shoes in tissue, our hearts in cotton wool. Our hair in spiral ringlets, uneven fringes of boyhood short, our knees in constant plasters. Our clothes dazz blue white, our ears red raw clean, our souls unscathed. You kept us, Mother, in little packages, snapshots of our life to remind you of when we'd gone. Then you left us, rooting through packages, looking for our pieces of you. And sometimes I think when you lose somebody who's so significant in your life, like a parent, it feels like your heart has just exploded inside you. And the loss of somebody can have a physical manifestation as well. It can cause physical pain. And this is called the hole. My heart shattered, smithereens of china particles, scattered fragments, littered my insides, embedded in my lungs, my bones, my kidneys. Large shards pierced my side, impaled me from within, raw and bleeding. X-rays and scans failed to detect the segments, the organ damage hidden. They could not alleviate the symptoms, and yet you found the cure. The ointment of the vanquished anointed me again and again, patiently waiting for a sign of repair, remission. You pierced my flesh with your finger, the pieces like iron filings migrating to your fingertip, allowing the organs to self-heal, each little scrap of heart finding its location, slowly rebuilding. The hairline cracks now the only reminder, except of course the hole where your finger fits, forever part of me. And all those major events in your life when you've lost somebody become even more, I suppose, intensified when you're missing them. And birthdays being one of them. And this is when, I suppose, my birthday, when somebody forgot my birthday and my mother wasn't there. So it's just called birthday. I bought a notebook for my thoughts, but all that's in my head is birthdays being squeezed out like toothpaste. I came arse first, nothing new in that. I'd have called if it was you. I'd have sent a card, said I loved you, remembered. I turned the sheets white, red and rosy from holding my breath from the bottom of my ragged little lungs, an atom-splitting scream. I can feel that tonight, the rawness of birth, my eyes hooded, listening in the half-light, frightened of the space around me, waiting for a familiar tone, just a sound. My tears are soft, sliding silent, but the pain is there, unbearable. She is not here to hold me. She left that role to you, and you forgot. Today I am born. So growing up, I suppose I was a bit of a tomboy, and losing a friend when you're growing up, when you're a kid, often, it's very significant, and I think sometimes parents don't realise how significant it can be for somebody to lose a childhood friend. And I suppose the other thing about this poem that I should mention, it starts in a hotel, arena because I wrote it at Bantry Literary Festival. I don't know whether you guys go to Bantry Literary Festival, but I love the place. I write there every year if I get a chance to go. It's been very creative place for me, so I can't say anything but good about it. So this is called Drop-Off Point. I sat out today listening to the lambs lament the cut grass of the football field. The noise of the German tourist wheeled luggage sparked a memory of that go-kart we made with the small ball-bearing wheels, a dead trap, my mother said. But we could only see perfection, the mobile front axle giving excellent cornering, my long legs folded on the plywood body, and your short stubby run to get us going, jumping on behind, screaming from the off down Mill Lane to the jump-off point before the road. How many hundreds of turns did it take before that one bockety wheel failed to stop, coming a cropper with a 1989 John Deere? That last summer, we picked up the dismembered pieces, lugged them home with plans of remodelling, a new improved chassis, a twin exhaust system. You were gone when I went to call you out. Unexpected, she said, gone back to live with your parents. I stood there on the high step, turning away from your grandmother, looking down the long field to the abattoir, the stink of blood in my nostrils, a butterfly in my throat, our new exhaust burning the tips of my fingers. I have four brothers. I read this at something recently and I was glad the four of them was there so I didn't have to dob in the one that is written about. I have one brother who's made into greyhounds, and he can put a greyhound into any conversation we have with him, in fairness. It doesn't matter what you're talking about, there will be a greyhound in there at some point. Or fishing, or cars, or the other things that he can actually get in there. So this is just called My Brother Rings. My brother rings. The bitch is sick again. She's always got some arse or an elbow and he's had enough. This is our last chance. If she doesn't cop on this time, she'll be swimming to y'all or starring on the X Factor singing for her supper. He talks about hawks, vet bills and cat flu before moving on to ferreting in Pike's Field, laughing at the hard ground of hills and hillocks neighbours known worldwide in the locality. He pissed on me when we were children. Out of the meal into the house, always in the shadows. I stood still, let him piss on me. I harboured physical hatred for that, grown from my mother's love for him, her unflinching belief that he would be there for me. I would spit with temper, not if I was dying would I ask him. He moves on to Father Joe. He has scour and needs to be segregated. He's worried about dehydration, rehydration, worried the pups will get it. She was right all those years ago. He is there for me. Not the man I thought he was at all. Still the double of my father. Gruff, uncooperative exterior, but soft as laughing cow cheese inside, which is how I feel at the moment. Mad as a brush, suited by dog talk and incidentals. He moves on to fishing, claiming his spot and ending up in his arse in the river. His rival doubled on the bank in stitches. His struggle with full waders makes me laugh. His ability to humiliate himself endearing. He might be back on Sunday with the girls, might take Razor and Trixie for a trial on Tuesday night, might need my help. Now he has to go, can't stay gossiping all night, there's a card game to go to. A significant thing for me was that my mother never got to meet my daughter. She died many, many years before my daughter was born. And I suppose this poem is for anybody who has children and who has ever got up at that unearthly hour of the night, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, to settle a child. And there's something about that time of at night when you have the child in your arms and they start to settle and it's so quiet and so still and there's no traffic and there's no noise and you're holding the child. And it actually feels like a time of night when spirits would be close to you. And this is called Being Your Mother. Being your mother, I eat the things you spit out. I bend to your will. At night when I hold you, my shoulders breaking from the strain of your 2-year, 2-stone body, like my ribs will crack and turn to dust. Deep inside a place I never knew existed, I sing. My breath catching in my throat, your fingers instinctively milking mine, settling into sleep, and still I hold you, pull you close. My muscles burn, the night ploughs on, but you and I are suspended in my mother's arms, her fingers curling in my hair, her breath, like mine, breathing in with yours, so close, I often think it's you are holding both of us. I'm going to start with an apology for this next book, about the language, all right, I'm sorry about the language before I start. I write for many different reasons. You know, somebody tells me something or something happens to me or, you know, just something inspires me. It could be a sentence that comes into my head or something like that, or words sometimes, you know, it depends. But this was actually a story that somebody told me one time, and I suppose it appealed to me for a number of reasons. One, because I have a very good relationship with my mother, and the person who told me the story didn't have a good relationship with her mother. And the other thing was because I hate interviews. I hate actually being on interview boards, and I hate being interviewed. I just think that the most horrible way to decide whether somebody's suitable for a job or not. They're rotten, like, they really are rotten. Because some people are actually very good at interviews. You know, it doesn't make them very good at the job, it means they're good at interviews.
Yeah.
That's my opinion anyway. But, so this is about an interview, it's called the interview. And it was about a very unusual interview question that I had not heard before. So it's called the interview. Where do you see yourself in 3 years' time? What strengths would you bring to the job? These were all questions she had prepared. But when they asked her to list three words her mother would use to describe her, bollocks, unreliable, selfish, bollocks, delusional, useless, bollocks, druggy, whore, we're not going to help her get this job. Convince these people to give her a shot. I'm sorry, I don't know, I've just gone blank. Myself and my mother have good fun, so I suppose she'd say fun. She could feel her toes curl in her high-heeled shoes. And she'd definitely say I was honest. Yeah, definitely honest. Her toes were curling, and she thought she could feel the tip of her nose stretching, aching forward. And trustworthy. Yeah, trustworthy. She knew then that the interview was over. Not from the interviewer's stifled yawn or the preceding eye roll. Not from the long pause. But the fact that she kept bringing her hand up to touch the tip of her nose, but from the realization that she was crying, saw tears streaking her mascara. Like I said, I came from a family of seven, so we lived in hand-me-downs, right? And I was the third youngest girl. So I had hand-me-downs of the hand-me-downs. And we used to get these parcels from America. I don't know where they came from. With clothes in them. And because I was the youngest girl, I had to wait until my sisters picked what they wanted from the parcel, which obviously they weren't going to leave anything worth anything behind them, because that was the way things happened. And the only other thing you need to know about this poem is what a Matryoshka doll is. I don't know whether you know that. It's a little Russian nesting doll. You open them up and there's a little one inside it. Okay, so the poem is called The Doll. Like all the hand-me-downs, I had presumed her empty. Spent like the elastic of the knitted tights my weak kidneys forced me to wear. Or the shoes whose tongues had tired of talking, lolling to the sides like dead badgers on my narrow pins. Raided by my sisters, cousins in America, friends of ours who didn't need them anymore. Her parcel arrived, holding the worst selection of rags my mother had ever seen, more holes than my rough wire. Shaking her weary head, she swept the beraggled bundle into her arms and squeezed her out from that cloth womb onto our kitchen floor, her roly-poly body rocking hypnotically to a slow stop, gazing intently at me. But it was only my insatiable curiosity that forced me to retrieve her, test her, for that wished for chocolate beneath her painted on clothes, and keeping her, despite my older sister's pick of parcels. She was my secret, Matryoshka, from that aged body, dried out, chipped and battered. A baby, pristine, perfect, pure. About how perceptive children can be, and often more perceptive than adults are. This is called inside out. You show me your belly and demand to see mine, poking the soft white flesh. You steal a pinch, watch the color change, putting your ear to skin in quiet concentration, listening for a trace, a murmur, a sign. You fashion your head, laying down in a different spot, disappointed at the nothing inside me. You raise your hands to your shoulders, palms upwards, level your long lashes and shake your two-year-old head. All gone? And you are wiser than all the adults, seeing more in my silent innards than they with their years and education. Yes, I say, covering my shame, all gone. But you have already forgiven me. Plucking your dhoti from its dangling chain, you take one long suck. Then offer me your comforter, knowing right now how much I need it.
You're nearly down a little. I hope I'm not boring you.
Falling in love with poetry is like having another person in a relationship with you. Because you love poetry, so you're thinking about a poem, and you should be thinking about what your partner is saying to you, because you're thinking, oh no, wait a minute, I have a poem in my head, don't talk to me now. So it's like having another person in a relationship, so that's what this poem is really about, I suppose. It's called I Go to Bed with Poems. I go to bed with poems, except when you're with me. No room for all of us, they take your space, filling your void with words, spreading down your side of the bed. Like a lover sprawled on the covers, sometimes spilling over onto the floor, notes and sheets and scribbles, rustling when I toss asleep, my arm draped over them and you and them beside me. They don't steal the blankets, leave cold flesh and frigid air, or wake me talking sleep nonsense in the night. They don't stay up late, watching rubbish on TV, smoking cigarettes before bedtime. They don't wrap their arms around me, whisper news into the darkness, make me laugh at nothing. They don't press their bodies to my back, stretch their toes along my soles, breathe a rhythm to my sleep. And when at 7, I force myself to rise, they don't sleep roll into my space, let my day begin in utter envy. Poetry Ireland run a poetry competition each year with Trokra, and it's an opportunity to write, I suppose. I decided to try it one year anyway. The topic was water, and I did all my research about, 844 million people live without access to clean water, 842,000 people estimated die each year from not having clean water. And I had all this information gathered, and I was going to write a poem about it. But in case you haven't noticed by now, I write about what impacts on me, I suppose. So when I sat down, water and me came back to my childhood and what I knew about water, and that's Tubberd Well in Mill Street, where I come from. There's a holy well called Tubberd, and it's a spring well, and it has a little grotto there, and it has a little place where you can get a cup and you can drink the water, and it's supposed to have powers to make you well and things like that. It's a very peaceful and very beautiful place. And I suppose there was always lovely water in Mill Street where I'm from, and that whole thing came back to me. That's what I suppose when I sat down to write this, that's what came out. And this is called Tubberd. I dip my cup in the water, watch the clear spring swim into the enamel, like a great tongue licking it clean, dousing it, letting the water flow out to gush amongst the rushes, baptizing spawns, salmon and eager tadpoles out into the countryside to pour itself into some unseen river. Blessed are the fish who swim here. Now it is my cup. I let the light flow in and drink as though I have walked all day to reach this shore, have not stopped or slept or eaten, have carried on my back all that I own, my newborn child begging for milk. The cold of the water startling as it makes its way through my tributaries, fills my lakes and corries, floods my wetlands, bubbling through to my skin. And I reach down, pick up my load and journey back amongst the non-believers, through the shanty towns, to the furthest point of nowhere, where I will give milk to my baby daughter, as though I am the well and I know only plenty. Last one. You've been a fantastic audience. Thank you very much. Thanks to Paul again for the invitation to read here tonight. This is probably a very bad poem to finish on now that I look at it, but you know, we're a bit late now, so
Draw now.
In a family of seven, if you got head lice, you were guaranteed to give it to your brothers and sisters. There was no two ways about it. The whole house was going to have head lice. And when I get those notes home from the school to say there's an outbreak of head lice in the school, I each automatically thinking we have them. We definitely have them, because we grew up with this whole, I suppose, rubbish about if your hair was dirty, you were going to get head lice, and what the head lice did, like they used to burrow into your scalp because you could feel them going in there, like, and all these kind of things. So we had all this misinformation that was complete rubbish. But it still comes back to you when you think about it. You think, oh no, do you know, maybe. Oh, God, yeah. So this poem is called What Her Mother Told Her. We said, you could fry an egg on her pole. Her mother said, washing took the nutrients from her hair. Our mother said, if that's what her mother said, we should respect that. Which was fine if you didn't have to sit next to her, the lice leaving in droves, and where else were they going to go but the nearly clean head next door, and you'd have your arse leathered for bringing them into the house. Even the dogs would shun you, and your head reeking like a Jay's Flute factory, bored from the dairy and the fine-tooth comb, the eggs falling to the newspaper by the fire. If you dare to eat, you'd get a clip around the ear. Don't be drawing unnecessary attention to your head. You could feel them burrowing into your scalp, birthing their eggs in deep pockets like the foxholes the soldiers made during the war. The nits hatching, breaking under the scalp. The babies crawling out, bawling for their mothers long dead from the fumes of the Lysol. And yet there was that one time I met her on the train, years after school and puberty, her hair still dripping. She melted as she asked what I was doing. I could feel my scalp tingle, the first egg cracked in the summit, the scrape of the nymph's tongue along my skull. She was working for a charity, she said, raising funds for poor and sick children. And despite myself, my heart broke for her and what her mother told her. Thank you very much.
Karen has some books with her, so if you're interested in buying them, go to her there. And you can also check out her more about Karen on www.karenoconnor.co.uk. Right. So that brings us to the end of that part, and we're gonna have another break, and then we'll have the open mic. So if you haven't already put your name down, just come up and let me know. And can we just have one big round of applause again? For Karen?